This Janet Meffer Today podcast is brought to you by Enemies Within the Church, a documentary that will expose the false teachers and underlying agenda to undermine the influence of Christ across the world. For more information, visit enemieswithinthechurch.com.
This is Janet Meffer Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Meffer.
Hey, everybody. Great to be with you again. I cannot believe this poll. Did you hear about this? YouGov.com poll that's just come out. The State of American Patriotism Survey conducted for the Foundation for Liberty and American Greatness. The Washington Examiner talked about this, saying younger Americans are turning on the country and forgetting its ideals, with nearly half believing that it isn't great, and many eyeing the U.S. flag as a sign of intolerance and hatred. These are Americans, younger Americans. Those who came of age under former President Barack Obama also have a larger-than-life view of him and feel that he had a bigger impact on the United States than George Washington. That's right, Obama, bigger deal, better president than George Washington, the founder of our country. Father of our country, I should say. Absolutely incredible. But what the poll found is that they have a lot of work to do when it comes to those 38 and younger. Just one example, 4 in 10 say it's okay to burn the flag. They quote this, younger Americans under the age of 38 are becoming unmoored from the institutions, knowledge, and spirit traditionally associated with American patriotism. Here are some of the highlights. Half of those surveyed believe the United States is sexist. 50% believe the United States is sexist, and 49% believe that the United States is racist. Now, this is just so easy to refute. How in the world can you claim that? Certainly, there are individuals you could point to and say that person is acting in a prejudiced way. Of course, there will always be people you could point to and say that about, but we fought a civil war to get rid of slavery. Can you think of other countries that have fought civil wars and hundreds of thousands of people died to stop slavery and overcome it and bring the Union back together, which occurred back in the 19th century? So we have a melting pot from sea to shining sea. We have people from all over the world, all different races, all different ethnicities, all different nationalities coming together under a set of ideals that we understand to be part and parcel of the American Republic. Sure, you're going to have a couple people here and there. Sure you are. But most of the people who love to throw around the word racist are lobbing it at people who genuinely are not racists. So I reject that. That is a huge, huge number of people. And what are they basing that on? I don't know. Maybe they watch too much Stephen Colbert. Who knows? Here's something else. American exceptionalism is on the decline. 46% of younger Americans do not agree that America is the greatest country in the world. Well, they came of age under Barack Obama. Why in the world would they think that? He was the same person who said American exceptionalism is the case the way British exceptionalism is the case and Greek exceptionalism is the case. And anybody with half a month sitting through a civics class when they were younger rolled their eyes and said, what is he talking about? Does he even understand what American exceptionalism has been, what it's all about, what it really means? Nobody in Greece is claiming Greek exceptionalism. That's nuts. But these kids, oh, Barack Obama can do no wrong. He's better than the father of our country, George Washington. So I guess if Barack Obama says it, it's got to be correct. Here's some more highlights. 38% of younger Americans do not agree that America has a history that we should be proud of. Well, right, because they were raised on Zinn and his history of the United States. We were colonialists. We were evil. We were racist. We were xenophobes. I mean, just go through Howard Zinn. And if that's been fed to you in your public school, then I suppose you would believe America has a history that we should not be proud of. But really what it speaks to is a number of Americans who don't really know what the history of the United States is. How many of these kids have ever read the Federalist Papers, for example? How many of these kids really have ever read the Constitution, have ever read the Declaration of Independence, or understand the Bill of Rights, or have any meaningful grasp of American history or the documents that are the founding documents upon which our republic was built? Very few, I would imagine. 1 in 8 of millennials agree that America was never a great country and it never will be. 46% of younger Americans agree that America is more racist than other countries. 46%. 84% of Americans do not know the specific rights enumerated in the First Amendment. Well, that would explain why you can have people with microphones going around American college campuses and quizzing them about hate speech. And you get so many people saying, oh, yes, this kind of speech should not be tolerated. Well, we should tolerate speech we don't like, because that's how we are created by the Lord to be able to speak freely, to be able to have ideas. And it is only within the free exchange of ideas in a free society that you can ever come to the truth. What is the alternate? The alternate is Orwell's boot stamping on your face forever. You really want to have that? You really want to have a totalitarian system in which the party decides what is right and wrong? And if you fall out of line with what the party decides is right and wrong, then you're in big trouble. I mean, look at Twitter. Twitter, oh, if you misgender somebody or you dead name somebody, then you're kicked off Twitter. This is the new rule that they've come up with. What is that really saying? What it's saying is you can't talk about the past. That's what dead naming is. It's a meaningless term, but what they're really saying is, again, as I've mentioned before, you can't say Bruce Jenner was ever Bruce Jenner. Well, why can't I say that? Because Twitter says you can't. Even though Twitter is not a publisher. Twitter actually has no right to censor your content based on expressing a view with which they disagree, but they're doing it. So that's another matter. Let's go on. 19% of millennials believe that the American flag is a sign of intolerance and hatred. 19%. And 44% of younger Americans believe Barack Obama had a bigger impact on America than George Washington, the nation's first president. Well, I suppose that history will tell the tale in the final analysis. I certainly will say that Barack Obama had an effect, an extremely negative effect. He was really what I would call the first anti-American president. So, yeah, he was America's first gay president, too, according to, what was it, Newsweek or Time that put him on the cover. So he certainly made his mark, but he made his mark as a radical community organizer who used to go to a church where they railed against America. And for some reason, the American people thought that was an appropriate person to put into the White House. It's so shameful. On the release of the report, Nick Adams, founder of Flag, said, "We suspected that we would find decreasing numbers of Americans well-versed in our nation's most important principles and young people less patriotic than the generations that came before. But we were totally unprepared for what our national survey reveals, an epidemic of anti-Americanism." He added that half of millennials and Generation Z, the teenagers, believe that the country in which they live is both racist and sexist. And it shows that we have a major fraction of an entire generation that has been indoctrinated by teachers starting in grade school that America is what's wrong with the world. Now, this is troubling on so many levels, but I'll tell you what's really troubling about it. This is also a generation that is increasingly seeing nothing wrong with socialism. Now, do I think we're going to have a 1917 moment here and, you know, Lenin and all his revolutionaries, a new version of them is going to come into the United States? No, I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think it has to happen. I think when you have a number of people who are absolutely convinced that their own country is evil based on not sure what, that we're not all a bunch of progressives, they're going to grow up. They're going to either wise up or they're going to change the country and fundamentally transform it into the nation that Obama wanted it to be. And I just grieve when I see this. This generation, at least those millennials who are bringing those numbers in the way they are, because not all millennials think that, obviously, but the millennials who are thinking this way are going to look back with unbelievable regret in the future if you allow the country that we have been given, this great republic that we have been given, to collapse because you bought into some kind of pie in the sky argument from a bunch of socialists. I can't even imagine. And it just goes to show that we need to be really in prayer for this country. There is a lot of work to be done. primarily bringing the gospel again to this nation, because it was the gospel itself and the Bible that formed the foundation for America in the first place. We have work to do. We'll be back on Janet Mefford Today right after this. I like to read, and whenever I can, I like to read the Puritans. John Gerstner once said that the Puritans constituted the greatest movement in the church since the days of the apostles. That's quite an endorsement. I'd like to recommend a publisher committed to the writings of these godly men. It's called Northampton Press. Men such as Jonathan Edwards, Thomas Watson, Jeremiah Burroughs, and John Bunyan are just a few of the great preachers they've put back into print for us. Many of these titles have not been available since the 1600s, but now they are in print. These books have been retypeset, slightly updated for modern readers, and printed in such a way as to last hundreds of years. I can personally recommend them to you, having read many of them myself. Mention Janet Mefford in the comment section of the order form and receive a free copy of the book Law and Liberty, A Biblical Look at Legalism, with any purchase. For more information, visit their website at northamptonpress.org. And remember, it's N-O-R-T, hamptonpress.org. How can Christians stand on God's word at a time when radical activists want to compromise the church on the issue of biblical sexuality? A rising tide of LGBT activism is becoming apparent inside our churches. Wearing a religious facade, these activists talk about LGBT Christians and sexual minorities, and their goal is to move our churches away from the word of God. It's time for the church to defend biblical truth without compromise. That's why I'd like to invite you to join me, Janet Mefford, at the God's Voice Conference, A Biblical Response to the Queering of the Church. Sponsored by First Stone Ministries, God's Voice will bring clarity to the confusion surrounding revoiced sexuality and identity. Our team of experts will demonstrate how the language of the LGBT Christian movement is rooted not in the Bible, but in the same ideology that has wreaked havoc on our culture. The God's Voice Conference will take place February 22nd and 23rd in Oklahoma City, and we want to see you there. It's time for the church to bow the knee to God's voice. To register or for more information, visit godsvoice.us. That's godsvoice.us. Welcome back. How then will they call on him in whom they have not believed? And how are they to believe in him of whom they have never heard? And how are they to hear without someone preaching? The words of Romans 10:14 have inspired generations of Christian missionaries to risk their personal safety and sometimes even their lives to bring the gospel of Jesus Christ to every part of the globe, as the Lord commanded his church to do. But what happens when a young Christian missionary obeys the Lord and loses his life in the process? As we know, that recently happened to a young pioneer missionary named John Allen Chow. He traveled to North Sentinel Island, whose inhabitants have no contact with outsiders, and they ended up killing him. But Chow even wrote to his family before his death, telling them, "You guys might think I'm crazy in all this, but I think it's worth it to declare Jesus to these people." Was Chow reckless for going to an island that is illegal to visit, as some people have charged, or was he a Christian hero in sacrificing his own life for the sake of the gospel, evoking memories of martyr missionary Jim Elliott? Well, my next guest knew him, and her organization helped train him and send him on his mission. Dr. Mary Ho is the All Nations International Executive Leader and oversees the training and support of her staff in more than 40 countries. And she is here to talk about her reaction to John Allen Chow's death and to share some of her personal perspective on his life and ministry. Dr. Ho, thank you for joining us. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Janet. It's good to be here.
Yes, this was such a sad story and so tragic, and it's been interesting to see how many people have paid attention to this story. Tell us a little bit about your contact with John Allen Chow and how you came to know him.
Yes, so, Janet, I just want to say first that here in All Nations, honestly, we're just still reeling. We're just in grief and in shock over John's death. We know him, we love him, and we're having many prayer vigils and prayer meetings to pray for his family, his friends, the North Sentinelese, and the people he loved.
Sure.
So, so we are just really still grieving. We first got to know John here in All Nations about 2 years ago. John Chow approach our nations about his life calling since he was 18 years old. He went on a mission trip and really felt like God called him into missions. And that same year, he Googled and discovered the North Sentinelese. And he knew right then that that's what God was calling him to do, to share the love of Jesus Christ with the North Sentinelese.
Goodness. So he really wanted to be a pioneer. That was a deliberate choice on his part.
Well, it is a deliberate choice because that is God's calling on his life.
Right.
And
right.
That's how we got to know him, because he approached us and we helped train him and help prepare him.
Yes. Now, much has been made about the fact that you were not allowed to visit the island, and should he have used
sure.
the strategy, that sort of thing. How did you train him? And what about all of those, you know, issues having to do with going there and the fact that this was illegal to go to the island? I understand that there
sure.
were there was a lifting of that restriction. What exactly went on in that regard?
Okay, sure. So in John's last newsletter to his family, his friend, his champion, he wrote about what we call the restricted area permit being lifted by the Indian Ministry of Home Affairs. And it's basically a travel ban to 29 islands, including the North Sentinel Island. And so All Nations missionary John Chow did not go there to break the law. He went into the country with a valid visa, and he went in knowing that the travel ban was lifted.
Okay.
He was really celebrating that this travel ban was lifted.
Right. Now, what sort of preparation were you involved in helping him with? Because certainly there would be a lot to train for before you go on a mission of that type. What sort of training did he receive?
Yes. So since about 18 years old, when All Nations missionary John Chow got the calling, his every single decision, honestly, was to prepare him for his life call. So, for example, he chose a college major in sports medicine, health, exercise science. He got himself trained in wilderness, EMT. He got training in linguistics and one of the best training. He got trained in cultural anthropology. We remember recommending about 30 books he should read, and he actually had read most of them before coming even to Our Nations, and the ones that he didn't read, he finished just like that.
Wow.
So after he came to Our Nations, he also came through, he also received our training in cross-cultural missions. And this includes things like how to honor other cultures, how, language acquisition, culture shock, how to share God's love in a culturally relevant way.
So was his strategy a strategy that All Nations had recommended, or was he free to choose that strategy of taking the boat in and having people transport him and going essentially by himself as a missionary? He didn't have other missionaries with him. Was that his own strategy that he was employing there?
So after All Nations missionary John Chow got to the Andaman Islands, the last time we had communication with him was around August 18th. And so some of the last-minute on-the-ground plans, detailed plans, we were not aware of.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Yeah. So, and we do know that there were several who were willing to go with him. But this is typical of John. He is extremely considerate, and he did not want to put anyone else's life at risk.
Yeah.
And that was a personal choice. But there were others who were willing to go in with him.
Right.
And so when I first personally met All Nations missionary John Chow, I was taken aback, because for someone with such a bold calling, he actually is soft-spoken. He is humble. He is very gracious in his demeanor, very considerate, polite. You can tell that he was very, very well raised by his parents, and he's always about the person that's right in front of him, and even the kids loved him. So he was just someone with a very gentle and considerate demeanor.
Right. Well, you can tell because he left behind his diary, as I mentioned, and a letter that he wrote to his family. And it's obvious that his heart was full of the love of Jesus Christ. That was why he was going. But he also said he was afraid to die. And there have been people who have said, should he have employed a different strategy? How do you see that as someone who heads up a missions organization in reacting and responding to some of the concerns people had about the way that he went about conducting his mission?
Yes, so the strategy for going in is different on a case-by-case basis. There is no way we can adopt a blanket strategy.
Right.
So this strategy is what he adopted, and it is different from what others would do. So there is no way we can just apply cookie-cutter strategy. There were many things about his strategy that was extremely relational. We know that our nation's missionary, John Chow, for him, this was not a weekend excursion, but he really planned to stay there long-term and build a genuine long-term relationship with them. And so a lot of, for example, the medical training and health training and linguistic training and cultural anthropology training he received was so that he could actually love and care for the North Sentinelese. And when he finally went in, he went with a gift. He introduced who he was because that is who John Chow is, someone who is very, very relational and loving.
Yeah, it's so, so tragic. And I think for those of us who have done missions before, myself included, there's a great admiration for him because it takes incredible courage to do what he did, to go into a place where no one has ever gone, so far as we know, to preach the gospel before. Could this end up being something that the Lord uses to bring this tribe to Jesus Christ? In other words, could God use his death to open doors for future missionaries to reach them, a la Jim Elliot, as so many Christians have talked about?
Yes, we believe that the Lord loves the North Sentinelese, and that one day the North Sentinelese would know the love and the goodness of Jesus Christ. And of course, none of us know how that will happen, but we believe that's what Jesus died for, and that he loves the North Sentinelese.
Absolutely. So what is next? I know that they have had difficulty retrieving his body. Have you heard anything as far as updates on where they are in, you know, getting John back so he can be returned to his family? Any news on that front?
Like you, we are all also waiting for more information, and we're gathering information.
Yes. Well, I'm sure that his family is heartbroken. I know that your organization and you, as you mentioned before, at All Nations, are quite heartbroken. And I think Christians worldwide are heartbroken because it was such a heart-wrenching story. And we're all praying, as you are, I'm sure, that the Lord will use this situation for the advancement of the gospel. I'm just so sorry for your loss and so appreciate your being with us. Dr. Mary Ho from All Nations International, thank you for the update, Dr. Ho.
Thank you, Janet.
Thank you so much. God bless, and we'll be right back.
Okay, God bless you. Bye-bye.
This Janet Meffer Today podcast is brought to you by Enemies Within the Church, a documentary that will expose the false teachers and underlying agenda to undermine the influence of Christ across the world. For more information, visit enemieswithinthechurch.com. We We are back on Janet Mefford today. As many have noted in recent years, Huxley's Brave New World no longer seems that fictitious because we now know that a Chinese scientist secretly led an unprecedented experiment to edit human embryos and create genetically engineered twin girls named Nana and Lulu using what is a gene editing tool called CRISPR technology. The ethical problems with this obviously are enormous. And what kinds of implications are there for this experiment now that the cat has been let out of the bag, so to speak? We're going to turn now to bioethics expert Wesley J. Smith, who wrote about this over at National Review Online. He is a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism. And always great to have you with us, Wesley. How are you?
Hi, Janet. It's a Brave New World Day, isn't it?
Oh, man. I loved that book, but I'm beginning to get a little nervous here. This really was wacky, wasn't it? This was in secret. This guy didn't have any oversight. How in the world did this ever happen?
Well, there are no very few rules that would have prevented it. I mean, we've had this kind of research moving forward at breakneck pace for a couple of years, this CRISPR, this gene editing technique. There have been announcements that there was going to be experimentation in gene editing or genetic engineering embryos. The National Academies of Sciences was all for it. And actually said that they believed, and this is, of course, a non-binding opinion, that gene editing babies would be something that could be done, assuming safety, if it involved a serious health issue. And so this Chinese researcher said, oh, well, you know, that's where we're going anyway. I might as well do it now and be the first one.
Oh, my.
I put a piece up, actually, on National Review just a few minutes ago. One bioethicist, a fellow named Ben Hurlbut, calls it shoot first, ask questions later science. Because everybody wants to be first and everybody wants to rush forward. And Janet, there's a big game being played here. The scientists, in quotes, say, well, let us create these voluntary guidelines and we'll make sure that the really controversial stuff doesn't happen. But you just let us do this more rudimentary research. But you understand that the rudimentary research that they want to do is to enable the more controversial research to come later.
Right.
And so what usually happens is they'll do the rudimentary research, and then when the controversial thing can be done, suddenly they'll say, well, you know, now it's ethical, and then they'll do it. The only thing that happened here was this fellow jumped the gun.
He jumped the gun. Now, what was the stated purpose for doing this, just because he felt like doing it, or was there some stated reason to genetically edit these twins?
Well, he had a reason, but it really is the former. He just wanted to do it, and he wanted to be first. His reason, he said, was to knock out a gene that may, I mean, it's not for sure, but may be involved in whether somebody in HIV infections. And apparently the father is HIV positive. But here's the thing. If you're going to do IVF or do artificial insemination, they can actually, what they call, wash the sperm and make sure that the sperm that is used to fertilize the egg is not HIV, does not have HIV. And that kind of passing on in that situation is very rare anyway. So really, this was not a necessary health predicate to having healthy children at all. It's because he wanted to do it. And by the way, guess what? This gene may have other uses other than the HIV issue. For example, I saw one article, I'm not a scientist, but this is what was in the article, that because of this genetic change, which, by the way, will now travel down the generations, this was germline engineering. Ugh. It isn't just affecting the babies. It is going to affect the baby's children and the baby's children's children on down the generations. This is because this was done at the very early embryonic stage.
Good grief.
Versus if you and I had a genetic problem and you used gene editing to fix me, a somatic fix, that would not pass down the generations.
Yeah.
You see the difference there.
Yeah.
But these babies may have a greater likelihood to be exposed to susceptible to flu was one of the things. You know, genes don't just do one thing.
True.
We don't understand the full way that genes express. It's an incredibly complicated situation, and this is a Tower of Babel approach.
Yeah.
It is just this rush when we don't have the wisdom, we don't have the knowledge, and I would say we don't have the right to create it, particularly germline changes, and alter what was either created by God or evolved over the millennia, as take your pick. Either way, human beings are the way we are because it's optimal for us, and to try to tinker with it at this point in a germline fashion in particular, I think is unethical and immoral.
Well, that's the thing. If you don't know the long-term consequences of having performed this sequence or CRISPR technology on these babies, you could be doing more harm than good. Maybe not.
Absolutely.
Not even just for them, but maybe for their descendants. I mean, that's horrible.
And these children are experiments. They're human experiments.
Yeah.
They're going to have to be followed closely for the rest of their lives to determine whether or not there's an impact in terms of their health because of this shift that was done in a way that apparently was legal, but was certainly unethical and wrong. And the scientists who are all screaming and howling, it's only because the con was shown for what it is. The same scientists often resist mandatory types of rules and regulations that would prevent such things from happening by force of law. Here in the United States, we have a very minor prohibition. We don't have a prohibition on genetically editing embryos. We just have a prohibition, and it's from the FDA, that treats that as a medical mechanism, that you cannot implant a genetically edited embryo in a uterus for the purpose of bringing it to birth. But that's a very weak read, and of course, it certainly does not have international scope.
No, and it makes me think of Jurassic Park. I'm sure a lot of people quote this back to you. But I mean, just because you can do it doesn't mean you should. Are those days long gone now?
Well, it certainly seems to me that this is an issue where the scientists should not be allowed to decide by themselves. Of course, they have a major input in the conversation. What is done? Because these are ethical and moral concerns, not scientific concerns.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we have to be concerned with more than just mere safety. And I say mere in the sense that if all that matters is safety, then it becomes a purely utilitarian outlook. And it denies human exceptionalism. You know, who are we to mess with the human genome? I mean, that's us at the primordial, the fundamental level of our biological beings.
Yes.
And the scientists often have this utilitarian view. Plus, hey, this guy was going to become famous. You know, I did it first.
Yeah.
You know, there was early, before the backlash happened, there was talk about, oh, he could win a Nobel Prize. Well, now suddenly he's a rogue scientist. Well, he's only a rogue scientist because he made the rest of them look bad. But I didn't see a whole lot of these other researchers saying, as a matter of principle, we should never do germline genetic engineering.
Good point.
And that we should prevent that by law permanently. I have not seen that. There may be a few, but I have not seen any of the major scientific organizations taking that position.
No, wasn't he supposed to be appearing at a symposium coming up?
Yeah, there was going to be this big symposium in Hong Kong. And of course, they were going to wring their hands and do the usual, voluntary guidelines, and we really do care about the ethics of this. Well, he blew that wide open. he blew the pretense of that whole approach wide open. And now they've got to deal with the reality that voluntary guidelines are only as good as the lowest common denominator.
Right.
If the lowest common denominator says, I want to do it anyway, the voluntary guidelines are meaningless.
That's exactly right. Well, like you say, I mean, if he thought he was going to be the next Nobel Prize winner, maybe he wanted to get himself a little advanced publicity, and there was enough of a backlash that kind of struck him back. But it really opens a big can of worms as far as bioethics goes, and we're going to get into some of that in just a few minutes. Wesley J. Smith is with us. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back on Janet Mefford Today right after this. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you'll access health care, so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 per month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org. Regain control over your healthcare costs. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. That number again, 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. Socialism is being purposely dressed up in Christian choir robes by once trusted and very influential church leaders. Their gatherings are growing in numbers as they shelve the true gospel and replace it with a false one known as the social gospel. What is this agenda to undermine the influence of Christ across the world? And whatever happened to powerful biblical Christianity? Noted producers Judd Saul, Trevor Loudon, Curtis Bowers, and Pastor Kerry Gordon of Cornerstone Church have joined forces to create enemies within the church, a hard-hitting international documentary that will reveal the plans and the players behind this movement and shine a bright light of restoration and hope upon Christ's church. To stay updated about this film and learn how you can support this important effort, go to enemieswithinthechurch.com and subscribe to the Enemies Within the Church newsletter. While you're there, be sure to enjoy a sneak peek of the movie. Go now to enemieswithinthechurch.com, sponsored by Cornerstone World Outreach International. That's enemieswithinthechurch.com. We are back on Janet Mefford today talking a little bit about that Chinese scientist who led this experiment to edit human embryos and create these genetically engineered twin girls. Wesley J. Smith is with us from National Review Online and the Discovery Institute. Wesley, how come we haven't seen these girls? Because these twin girls did not appear in the video. Has anybody seen them?
I'm not aware of that. And he might have been wanting to bring them out and show them at this big conference. And it's always possible that this is a scam. I want you to remember during the George Bush administration, a Korean researcher said that he had cloned human embryos and that they had been brought, that he had cloned human embryos.
Yeah.
And created stem cells from them. And there was a huge hue and cry. It turns out he was a fraud. Wang Wu-suk is his name. He's still, by the way, allowed to do research. You may remember when the head of the Raelians, that's a science cult.
Yes.
Went on TV to say we've got clone babies. And at the time there was a CNN host who even agreed to call him Your Holiness on TV. It was ridiculous. Connie Chung.
Oh, gee.
Called him Your Holiness on TV because he insisted on it, got the big interview. And of course that was a fraud. Yeah. I suspect this is true because all the bellowing on the part of science organizations, because as I said in the previous segment, the con is up. The game has been shown for what it is. And so now he's this rogue scientist. So I don't think it didn't happen. Frankly, I hope it didn't happen. I hope he's a fraud, because if he's not a fraud, two people have been created as an experiment. And that also, by the way, probably means that in order to get this far, this fellow has probably been creating embryos, genetically engineering embryos, has then destroyed them to test them to see how the expression was going. And it's possible, as I wrote in yesterday's piece on this issue, based on what I was reading, he might have actually done it to fetuses as well, meaning implanted for a while, gestate for a period of time, and then have an abortion and then investigate the dead fetus to see how that was going. I don't know that that occurred, but if you're going to figure out how to do this so you can get to a safe birth, that would be the normal process you would go through in terms of scientific step by step, right?
Yeah, right.
And so, I mean, are we going to be okay? Are we going to say that it's okay to create embryos, which we are doing, genetically engineering them and then destroying them for to check to see how it worked? And if so, then why can't we do fetuses? What's the difference? Why can't we implant a fetus, particularly if we get, artificial uteruses, artificial wombs? Why not put them in 3 or 4 months and then take them out and check them out? Because if we only view human life as having value based on our capacity, say, to be self-aware, or if we're born, then we can use unborn life as a mere potter's clay.
Yeah, there's
nothing to stop us. And that's why you see people like Peter Singer, the utilitarian bioethicist, saying, well, why not have experiments on fetuses? Why not have, you know, infanticide? You've had a guy named Jacob Apple arguing in the Huffington Post, we should have fetal farming. We should pay women to gestate longer so that the organs of the dead fetuses can be used. Because if we look at human life as nothing more than just basic material for experimentation and having no intrinsic value simply merely because it's human, well, at some point there are certain humans you'd redefine as less valuable than others so that you can use them in an objective and a exploitive manner.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you mentioned Peter Singer. I was thinking of him as well when you were describing all of that. And I thought, Peter Singer, isn't he the same one who went to great lengths to take care of his elderly mother?
Well, you know, that's the interesting thing about that. He said he had a mother who got Alzheimer's, and he took very good care of her.
Yeah.
And Peter Singer is the one who says that if somebody is not self-aware over time or is unable to value their own life, they're not a person. And therefore, that a non-person has lower value than a person. And among the so-called human non-persons would be somebody who had lost those capacities, such as my mother who died of Alzheimer's and my uncle who died of Alzheimer's and Peter Singer's mother who died of Alzheimer's. But then when Peter Singer was challenged on that, he said, well, it's different when it's your own mother. Well, my gosh, he had a heart instead of just a brain.
Yeah, what a concept. Yeah.
You know, and at least he was raised right, because there was something that remained in him that did not permit him to actually effectuate his own personal value system. And I'm happy about that.
Yeah.
But I think it's very telling that even he would not take his own value system to the point that he has espoused publicly.
Yeah, that's true. Well, the other thing, when I think about the nation of China and the brutality of that country, especially when it comes to the unborn and forced abortions and all the rest, how can you really have informed consent on this kind of issue? Because that scientist was claiming the parents had informed consent before he did this experiment and, you know, altered the embryos of these girls. How do you really have an assurance, though, that these parents did have informed consent? I mean, this opens all sorts of ethical problems, does it not?
Yeah, well, this is the problem. And a lot of people, and including researchers in this country, do what my friend William Hurlbut, who is Ben Hurlbut's father, calls outsourcing ethics, meaning we have the rules here that are ethical rules regarding human research. Well, if researchers want to do something that this country wouldn't think of as ethical, they'll go to Africa or they'll go to China. And we've seen before where some researchers associated with American universities or research institutions will do things out of the country involving people not subject and institutions not subject to our laws, which they couldn't do here. That's why this has to become international, because if you end up with rogue countries, which become anything goes Isle of Dr. Moreau kinds of jurisdictions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you're going to have ethical research done here and other places. And then when people really want to do things that are really nasty, they'll go to those places without the ethical consequences. So what's going to have to happen are not only, I think, international research protocols, but we're going to have to make it so that if somebody actually does something unethical in a place where it might not be illegal, that they're not allowed to bring their products or their research into places where it is ethical. Because if we don't draw firm lines in the sand, if we say, oh, well, since it's okay in Ivory Coast, I'm just picking a name, where perhaps there isn't the kind of centralized control to properly govern these ethics. And if we say, well, since we can do it there, we should do it too, or we should allow it anyway, then we're no better than the people who would allow these kinds of things to go forward.
Very true.
But we have to be willing to sacrifice for ethics. We have to be willing to sacrifice for morality. Mm-hmm. And if we're not, then give up the pretense and
for
just
sure.
say, what all we care about is getting these advances because hopefully they'll help us. And if somebody else gets hurt, that's too bad. But that's the kind of world we're in. Well, then at least let's be honest about it.
Yeah, pick a side. But the problem is, you and I have talked about before, is the state of bioethics. I mean, Peter Singer still has a job. We have a lot of these.
He's got the most prestigious chair in bioethics in the world at Princeton University.
Wow.
He wasn't at Princeton in spite of these youths, he was brought there because of them after a search.
Yeah, that's just, it's
so
deplorable.
The people who hold human rights bioethics or pro-life bioethics or Hippocratic Oath type bioethics are few and far between, and they usually have the modifier conservative or Catholic or Christian or something of that sort in front of their name. The mainstream bioethics movement, to a greater or lesser extent, follows this kind of more utilitarian thinking. Just as an example, one of the other things I'm trying to fight right now is the advocacy in bioethics that people be able to write an advance directive so that if they get dementia and lose their competence, that they are forced to be starved to death, meaning with having spoon feeding withheld from them.
Yeah.
So if you have a movement that is so devoid of a belief in the intrinsic sanctity of human life, simply because it's human, and if the prime directive, if you will, is to eliminate suffering, because that's the utilitarian outcome, well, that very quickly moves into eliminating the sufferer. And then you go from, well, we'll take away feeding tubes from people like Terry Schiavo because a feeding tube is a medical treatment, and that we're not really killing her, we're just withdrawing a medical treatment. Okay, well, spoon feeding isn't a medical treatment. Oh, yeah, but these people don't want to live. So you see what they do? They move the goalpost.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and that's why everybody needs to read your stuff. Wesley J. Smith, nationalreview.com, always an honor. Wesley, thank you so much for being here again.
Thanks for having me, Janet.
All right. Thank you. God bless. And thank you for joining us on Janet Mefford Today. We'll see you next time.